Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Paris, a draft climate agreement is taking shape. So is the unavoidable question of the dollars and cents cost of a climate accord. Who's going to pay to help keep nations to that average global temperature rise at the 2-degree centigrade target? Quite frankly, developing nations say it should not be them. Here's Gurdiel Singh Nijjar, a diplomat from Malaysia who spoke in Paris on Saturday.
We have extreme poverty. For example, in China, India, the per capita income is very low. To then not proceed on the pathway of progress of industrialization means that the per capita income has to be reduced even further. We cannot accept starvation as a price for the success of this agreement.
And in anticipation of that objection, President Obama has pledged some $3 billion towards a $100 billion international annual fund to help poor countries pivot towards clean energy sources. However, Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe and many of his fellow Republicans pretty much hate the idea.
When it comes to the financing, I know that a lot of people over there, the 192 countries, are going to assume that Americans are going to line up and joyfully pay $3 billion to this fund, but that's not going to happen either.
So we return to that fundamental question. Who could, or rather who should, pay the actual cost associated with any climate agreement that could come out of Paris? Well, Robert Stavins understands the complexity of that question probably better than anyone else. He's the director of Harvard's Environmental Economics Program and the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. And he spoke with us earlier today from Paris. And I began by asking him about one of the central goals of the climate talks, holding that increase in global average temperatures to just 2 degrees centigrade. I asked him, what would it cost to achieve that?
Well, the important thing to recognize is that that 2-degree target is not going to be reached by the Paris Agreement. This is simply the first step. If they actually tried to achieve it immediately with this agreement, then it would be terribly costly. What we're looking at now, if you want to think in terms of the United States, the costs vary tremendously from one part of the country to another. So to give you sort of the range, for Kentucky, we're talking about $30 per ton of CO2. That's going to increase electricity prices by something between 35% and up to 80%. For California, the cost is the marginal cost is zero because they already have a state policy in place.
And in Kentucky's case, they're a big coal state.
They rely so heavily on coal, and they have a relatively ambitious target in a domestic regulation called the Clean Power Plan, which is a fundamental element, not the only one, but it's a key element of the U.S. strategy for implementing the target for Paris.
I mean, how do we best quantify how much it would cost the United States to achieve the 26 to 28% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 that we're looking for?
Yes, essentially, by the year 2030, we're probably talking about something on the order of at most 1% of gross domestic product. Now, is that a big number or is that a small number? If you ask green advocates, they'll say, well, look, that's a very small number. That's not going to push the U.S. into recession. That's just shaving off about 0.06% per year of economic growth. On the other hand, someone can look at that from the flip side and say, well, you're talking about billions of dollars, and they'll claim it's a large cost. I think by most reckoning of people that are somewhat politically neutral on this is that it is a significant cost, but it's not a cost that by any means is going to cause large economic hardship in the country.
But, of course, as you know, it would cause or already is causing significant political turmoil. So, I mean, before we get to the details of that particular aspect of the Paris talks, I did want to just get your sense about the global cost of climate change action or lack of action thereof, because we were looking at a figure quoted in the journal National Affairs from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that says that the expected economic cost of global warming over 100 years from now is likely to be about 3% of worldwide GDP. Does that sound in the ballpark to you?
Well, you'd be very, very careful about extrapolations to 100 years from now, but it's best to think out, you know, 10 years, 20 years.
And so give us a 10-year number, yeah.
So the 10-year number, those are still reasonable. So you're thinking of, you know, the climate damages in 10 years, there aren't a lot of climate damages. They get more severe 30 years out. So 30 years out, you could be talking globally something on the order of 2% of gross domestic product, gross world product, in terms of damages of climate change, and the cost of action somewhat less than that. In other words, the anticipated benefits are greater than the anticipated costs. But importantly, that's at the global level. It's not the case at the individual country level, because when an individual jurisdiction, whether it's the state of Massachusetts, the city of Boston, or the entire United States takes action, we incur the costs of that action, going from coal to natural gas to renewables, for example. But the benefits are spread globally, because it doesn't matter where the greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, come from. They have the same effect. So benefits are spread globally. Costs are concentrated locally. That means for any jurisdiction, for themselves, the benefits of action will inevitably be less than the costs of taking action.
So isn't this one of the fundamental... maybe you're just about to get this, but that's kind of one of the fundamental problems, is that it's not so easy to ask people to take action, especially when it costs them something where they may not receive 100% of the benefit.
That's precisely right. That's the heart of the problem. That's why for other environmental problems, you know, that we have under five major environmental laws in the United States for air pollution, water pollution, hazardous waste, solid waste, and the like, we've done that on our own. We didn't need an international agreement because we pay the cost, but we also get the benefits. But with climate change, it's not that way, and that's why international cooperation is necessary. We can't rely upon individual countries. It's what economists would call a global commons problem, bringing up a free rider issue. It's in the interest of every country to wait for others to take action.
Well, so we began this segment with a little bit of tape from a representative from Malaysia who basically said that that he and other members of the developing nations do not wish their own economic growth to be curtailed at all by any agreement that comes out of Paris. How much is that very deep-seated and understandable desire? Could it derail these talks in any way, or does that $100 billion fund that you were mentioning, we were discussing earlier, assuage those concerns?
This is a central issue going back to 1992, when these talks really started with the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, is the division, you could say, between the industrialized world and the developing world. So the perspective of the developing world, quite understandably, is to look at this and say, wait, climate change is a consequence of accumulated emissions into the atmosphere, because they don't come out of the atmosphere quickly. They stay there for 100 years in the case of CO2. So it's the stock that matters. They say, wait, it's your fault in the industrialized world. We shouldn't have to pay. We're suffering, but we didn't do anything. People in the industrialized world look at this and say, well, wait, emissions in the industrialized world in every country are flat to declining. All of the growth in emissions is in the large emerging economies, China, India, Brazil, Korea, South Africa, Mexico, and Indonesia. That's where the growth is. So if you take a forward-looking perspective, they have to be involved. My view of this, and I think increasingly the view that will win the day in Paris as we go forward, is to separate out who pays from who takes action. In other words, the developing countries have to get on the global climate policy train, or it's not going to leave the station. It's just going to spin its wheels. That doesn't mean they have to pay for their tickets. These are two separate issues.
Mm-hmm. What would be the cost to India, Indonesia, Malaysia, these developing countries, if no action is taken on climate change?
Well, in fact, that's a good point, because the greatest damages of climate change are not going to be in the United States. They're not going to be in Europe. They're not going to be in the temperate regions of the globe. Rather, they're going to be in developing countries for two principal reasons. One is that in any economy, the most climate-sensitive sector of the economy is agriculture. And by definition, the industrialized countries rely less upon agriculture to fuel their economies than developing countries do. Second, because of the nature of climate biophysically, the greatest impacts are going to be in the equatorial regions plus at the two poles, not in the temperate regions. And of course, it's the temperate regions where virtually all of the wealthy countries of the world are located. So developing countries are the ones who are going to suffer. That's why, to answer your previous question, I don't think that these disagreements regarding who takes action and who pays are going to derail the talks in Paris. Because at this point, no one wants that to happen. And most importantly, the two largest emitters, by far the two most important countries, China and the United States, who have converged tremendously in their positions on climate change, together accounting for 40% of global emissions approximately, they don't want this to fail.
You know, given everything that you said, Robert Stephens, suddenly it occurs to me this $100 billion annual fund, international annual fund to help developing nations sort of pivot more quickly towards clean energy sources, seems like a drop in the bucket.
Well, it's a beginning. It's a symbolic action. Now, I don't think anyone suggests that necessarily compensates developing countries fully for the costs that they will incur for mitigation, but it's a beginning.
Mm. Well, finally, Robert Stephens, so no matter what happens in Paris and what kind of accord ultimately takes shape, I mean, I think there is pretty much universal agreement, not politically necessarily, but economically, that really the best way to get a control on emissions is to put a price on carbon for us, you know, as individuals and as nations to have to pay the true price of carbon. Is there anything that could come out of Paris that would push the United States specifically closer towards, I don't know, cap and trade or a carbon tax? Any actual fundamental policy changes here in that direction?
So you're absolutely correct that the lowest cost way to achieve any target in the case of climate change of CO2 emissions reductions is with a carbon pricing policy, whether that's a carbon tax or a CO2 cap and trade system. In Paris, several things are happening. The first one, though, recognized that the decision of what policies countries should actually use to achieve their targets, that's the province of national sovereignty. So it's not directed from here. But there, it should be said that there is tremendous interest in the hallways at the negotiating site in Paris, in Le Bourget, for making sure that the agreement does not get in the way of carbon markets.
But, you know, on the other hand, is it fair to say that the interest pretty much dies when you reach the halls of Congress?
Well, so, that, you know, one could diagnose why it was that the Waxman-Markey legislation in 2009 passed the House of Representatives and then failed in the Senate. But the reality is that carbon pricing, indeed any kind of climate policy, because Waxman-Markey was a lot more than cap and trade, failed at a national level. However, since then, what we've gotten are heightened fuel efficiency standards on motor vehicles and appliances. We've got the California cap and trade system. And now, very importantly, we have the Clean Power Plan under the Clean Air Act that the Obama administration is going forward with. This patchwork from the bottom up at the state level and at the regional level, is it equivalent to a national carbon pricing system? Absolutely not. It is inferior to that. And I think the Obama administration, they'd be the first ones to acknowledge that. This was the second best or the third best approach to take. But I think what we're going to see is this patchwork from the bottom up through these different states linking together being something like a national cap and trade system. I'm not saying it'll be every state. In fact, it'll probably be the blue states. That looks geographically like a relatively minor or small part of the country, but economically and in terms of emissions, it's a huge part of the country.
Robert Stephens is the director of the Harvard Environmental Economics Program and the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. He's speaking to us from the Paris Climate Talks. Robert Stephens, thank you so much for joining us today.
Meghna, it was my pleasure.
And we spoke with Robert Stavins as part of our ongoing series of a Boston view of the Paris climate talks. You can go to our website, radioboston.org, and listen back to the many other segments we've done on this really fascinating series of conversations. Again, that's at radioboston.org. Stick with us. There's more of the show coming up in just a bit. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.